The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman. I'm a producer and editor here in the Free Library's author events office, and I'm pleased to be here to introduce tonight's guest, Amelia Pang. In 2017, Amelia Pang earned the first place award in investigative journalism from the LA Press Club for her undercover expose on the exploitation of immigrants smuggled into America to work in Chinese restaurants, covering topics such as sexual violence on Native American reservations, economic hardships for immigrant Americans, and organic import fraud. Her writing has appeared in The New Republic, Mother Jones, and the New York Times Sunday Review, among other publications. She currently works as an editor at EdTech Magazine. Her debut book is titled Made in China, A Prisoner, An SOS Letter, and the Hidden Cost of America's Cheap Goods. Of it, NPR says, Amelia Pang has written a powerful new book that traces what we buy back to those who made it, often under truly torturous conditions. It tells the story of a Chinese political prisoner and forced laborer's desperate missive, and the larger story of how a vast array of products come from brutal slave labor camps. But I think it's important to note that it's not just about China. Chris Hedges writes of tonight's author and her book, "She forces us, like the abolitionists who battled slavery in the 19th century, to place the sanctity of human life before the maximization of profit." It is hard not to finish this book and not be outraged, not only at the Chinese government, but the American corporations that knowingly collaborate with and profit from this modern slave trade. Tonight, Amelia will be in conversation with Tracy Matisak, who must surely these days be setting a record for interviews on our stage. In addition to being a great friend to the Free Library and the Author Events Program, she is also an award-winning journalist and broadcaster. Here to tell you more about this fascinating and necessary topic, Amelia, Tracy, thank you both for being here, and take it away.
Well, thank you so much, Jason, and welcome, Amelia, to the Free Library of Philadelphia. Thank you for writing this book. I was telling you earlier that I learned so much from it, and I'm sure that our audience will, and for all of those who are yet to read the book, I'm sure that they will learn a great deal from it. So thank you so much for writing it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Tracy and Jason. I really appreciate that introduction.
So the book is about forced labor camps in China, but the story begins, interestingly enough, in a suburb of Portland, Oregon. What happened there?
Yes, in 2012, an American woman named Julie Keith, she is this mother of two young children, planning a Halloween party for one of her kids. And she decides to look in her garage to see what decorations she has and realize she has this unopened one that was gifted to her 2 years ago. And it was from Kmart that somebody had gotten really cheap when it was on clearance on sale after Halloween 1 year. And she decides to open this product. And as she's tearing open the cellophane and pulling out the wrapping paper, out falls an SOS letter that's written by the political prisoner in China who had made and packaged this very product. His letter was a cry for help. It says the prisoners there are tortured. They have to work 15 to 20 hours a day. They are just begging whoever finds this note to please, please contact a human rights organization and get help for them. And, you know, I really wanted to focus on this particular political prisoner story as opposed to other ones, because there's so many, and there's so many of these types of letters that have entered American stores throughout the years, with the earliest one happening in the early 1990s even. But his story was just especially chilling because he was making a Halloween decoration at a labor camp where there were actually like unmarked graves and people were buried there.
Yeah, really powerful story. These labor camps, of course, are nothing new. In China, the country has a centuries-old history with forced labor. And if I remember right, the number was that there were something like 1,400, give or take, of these labor camps scattered around the country, although it's hard to, I guess, get an exact number. Who are these laborers, Amelia, and how did they end up in these camps?
Oh, yes, there's many different types of forced laborers in China. You know, a lot of the listeners today may have heard of the Uyghurs and other Turkic minorities. There's a large number of them detained in re-education camps at the moment, anywhere between 1.5 to 3 million, some sources estimate. And that that's just one demographic of forced laborers in China. There's also a lot of political prisoners, civil rights lawyers, religious dissidents, and even petty criminals who haven't necessarily committed any kind of serious or violent crime. They're just really there to fill up a seat in the forced labor factory.
So how do they end up there? I mean, are trials held? Are they sentenced to these camps? How do they end up in these places?
That's a great question. You know, there's some prisons where they have gone through a trial and been sentenced, but even those numbers, even those trials are not very fair, because China prosecutes 99.9% of all cases that go through their courts. But most of these places, the people have not gone through trial. These are extra legal detention centers with kind of innocent sounding names, such as drug detox center or pretrial detention center or vocational training center. But they're all really forced labor factories where detainees have to do manufacturing work, and they're kind of held there indefinitely until whenever the camp feels like releasing them.
What kinds of products are they making there?
I don't know what they're not making in there. When I went to China in early 2019 to visit the camps, I followed the trucks that left these camps to see which exporters they were working with. And they, like, the one camp would work with all kinds of exporters. They would, you know, work with everything from a pharmaceutical to a factory that made pet products, and to even an Apple factory. An official Apple supplier was working with one of these camps. And so I don't think the camp is necessarily making the entire product from scratch. It might be just one part, or maybe just the packaging, but they're working with many, many types of exporters making all kinds of products for us.
Is there a way to get a fix on how many people are in these camps, and how many of them may be children?
Oh, it's hard to, there's millions of people in these camps, really, because, I mean, just, again, just in the Uyghur camps alone, there's anywhere between 1.5 to 3 million. And there are children as well. I called some of these camps, including one that said it was a juvenile detention center. When I called them, the person who answered the phone said, absolutely, we do make products for here, we can export to you. I told them I was from a fake company overseas that wanted to buy stuff from them. And you know, they had a sales department just like any other labor camp in China. And they were very professional, oddly, weirdly professional about how they engage with their potential customers.
And yet within these camps, the conditions are unspeakable, the way that you've described them.
Oh, yes, there's... people are malnourished. People have to work really long hours, 15 to 20 hours a day. And a lot of times they are tortured if they're not, and heavily beaten if they're not producing the products at a fast enough rate to meet the daily quotas, which are often like an unrealistically high quota. And in a lot of the female camps, sexual violence is very prevalent, very disturbing kinds of violence where we're learning in the Xinjiang re-education camps that the women are being even sold to men who will come in to purchase them. And it's all, the camps are definitely not a normal factory.
Yeah. And it's easy for us, Amelia, to, you know, stand at a distance and just shake our heads at the conditions there. But in the book, you lay the blame squarely at our feet as consumers, because we want more and more, better and better, faster and faster. And you talk about how we contribute mightily to what's happening over there.
Yes, I spoke with Chinese auditors who audit the factories for our companies. And they say, based on the way that audits are currently designed, I know that they're using prison labor because it's so common, but I can't tell from the audits. I can't tell from the way that the audits are designed by your companies to, I can't detect forced labor. And so a lot of our companies will brand themselves as sustainable and ethical. Most will have either a sustainability page or a corporate social responsibility page, talking in depth about how they would never use forced labor or never encourage their factories to use it. But yet the way that they source from these factories and their relationships with these factories strongly encourage them to use forced labor. The prices that they give to the factories are often a lot of times so low that the factory cannot realistically make it in-house or subcontract the work to an approved normal factory. They kind of have to outsource their work to somewhere really shady and illegal, like a labor camp where, you know, the people there are either extremely underpaid or not paid at all, as in the case of most labor camps. And another factor that is causing Chinese factories to outsource work to forced labor is the unrealistic production deadlines that a lot of companies are giving their normal factories. And the reason why the prices are so low and the deadlines are so tight is because they're often just trying to meet our consumer demands. You know, we love to buy things that are extremely cheap and extremely trendy. You know, we're always searching for the latest trends in all different types of products and industries. So at the end of the day, there is blood on our hands too, because we're contributing to our company's sourcing practices. But the good news is there are things that we can do to encourage companies and encourage factories to not use forced labor. And my book does talk a lot about that as well.
And I absolutely want us to spend some time on that, because I think that is the $64 million question, is what can we do, you know, to try to bring an end to this, or at least to mitigate this in some way. But a couple of things before that. Number one, I was thinking about fast fashion in reading your book, you know, where there's just this demand for such a quick turnaround with fast fashion. And is there a way to understand to what degree just that industry may contribute to the existence of these forced labor camps?
Yes, that's a great point. I mean, the fashion industry is definitely not the only industry using forced labor, but they are a huge contributor. I mean, fast fashion is one of the slower forms of fashion at the moment. Now there's ultra fast fashion, where, you know, companies like Fashion Nova, the CEO has famously said he can turn something from a design into actual clothing in less than 24 hours. So that kind of a time frame, you know, Fashion Nova and companies like them that are primarily only online and really chasing after the latest trends and being the first to sell the latest trends, a lot of them are extremely profitable, and it's pushing companies throughout the fashion industry to try to shorten their production deadline even more to keep up with their trends that they're setting. So yes, it's definitely a huge contributor, because I mean, realistically, how do you think it's possible for something to turn from design into a distributed product on the other side of the world? Like, something's got to give.
You mentioned sustainability just a moment ago, and you know, you hear about companies doing audits to try to make sure that their sourcing is legitimate. But you know, those audits, according to your book, don't really give us a great picture of what's really going on, that all audits are not the same. How does that work, and why do these audits not really give us the full picture?
Yes. There's many different types of audits, and a lot of times they're designed more to protect the company than the actual workers. For example, whenever a company like Kmart or Walmart or even more expensive ones, whenever an SOS letter or something like that is found in their product, they always release a statement that says something along the lines of, we conducted an audit, we looked at our past audits and found no evidence of forced labor. But what does that actually mean? I would encourage consumers to start pushing back and start asking all of our companies, what are you actually looking for in your audits? Because like you said, not all audits are equal. There's you know, the cheaper ones that might cost a couple hundred dollars, and they'll only look for things like quality of the merchandise, quality of the equipment, how clean the factory is, and, you know, simple things like that. It can't really detect something as complex as hidden subcontracting to forced labor. And then you have more expensive ones that might cost $1,000 or more, and they'll probably interview the workers and look more into workers' rights and conditions and things like that. But even those, auditors tell me, cannot detect secret subcontracting to labor camps. The only audit that may be able to at this point is a really expensive audit that costs $5,000 or more to conduct, and it takes 5 days to complete. It's a really extensive one where the auditor will look at the records and production records and all the records in multiple departments and really cross-analyze everything to try to detect if the factory is really making everything in-house or really sourcing from where they say they're sourcing from. But how many companies are actually doing those kinds of audits for most of their factories? I question that. That information is not really revealed right now in most companies' sustainability pages or corporate social responsibility pages.
And then when you think about the kind of money that so many of these companies are making in their profits, I mean, $5,000 doesn't sound like a huge investment to try to get to the bottom of this.
Right. You have multi-million-dollar companies and billion-dollar companies. It's really not a lot for them. And I would argue that, yes, for a lot of companies, maybe that is a huge investment, and that they can't realistically do that. But there are other things you can do, maybe simple, maybe even cheap things that you can do to really discourage your factory from using forced labor and to show them that you're serious with the forced labor. But as far as I can tell, I haven't come across any companies that's actually doing anything like that.
What about the U.S. government, Amelia? Just last month, just before the Biden administration took over, the Trump administration announced a ban on Chinese cotton, and I think it was tomatoes as well, and products that are made from those things. And I wonder, will that make any significant difference?
If they continue with the bans, it will. That is a pretty significant step. It won't solve the issue, but it was definitely worth doing, because up until then, or up until the last year, really, the U.S. government really banned one type of product at a time from one specific supplier. It was more of a band-aid solution to stop forced labor, because it was so tedious to ban just one type of product from one factory. You couldn't do any large scale bans like all cotton or all tomatoes. So this was really one of the first of its kind. And it was pretty significant in that manner, because Xinjiang is a key region where a lot of forced labor is happening, and where trade in Xinjiang is very, very important to China. China has invested a lot of money into making that area successful, a trading area. So it was significant in that sense, but that act alone is not going to, in my opinion, end the labor camps in China or cause China to rethink its policies.
In the book, you talk about how for the last like 30 years or so, the U.S. government has had sort of a half-hearted response to this, or has sort of undertaken a half-hearted effort to really try to get to the bottom of this. Can you talk about why that is, and maybe some of the roadblocks that government investigators run into when they set out to investigate?
Yes, I do talk about a lot of these roadblocks in my book. I think in the last maybe two decades or so, the U.S. government has really been, I think, hopeful that maybe China would turn towards a democracy and start valuing human rights, as long as you kept trading with them, as long as China's economy kept improving and developing. But I think most people can agree that just hasn't been the case, including Democrats, you know, who traditionally have been more of that kind of a stance. You know, I think everyone can agree that China has taken a really authoritarian turn in recent years. You know, the president Xi Jinping made himself president for life. You know, there's been a lot of recent changes that are extremely authoritarian. It seems like there's governments around the world who are, at this point, thinking of taking more serious actions in a way that hadn't been considered before.
Yeah. And as you write in the book that, you know, corporate America certainly has to some degree an interest in kind of looking the other way as it relates to the manufacture of these goods at these labor camps. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the role that companies have played and the fact that it seems that only one company has been prosecuted for dealing with these labor camps, knowing that, in fact, there was forced labor there?
Right. It's extremely, extremely hard to gather enough evidence for it to lead to any kind of prosecution, because rarely do you get to talk to survivors who can actually discuss in detail what specific supplier the factory was working with or the camp was working with. Most survivors either don't make it out of China or just simply don't have that kind of knowledge. So it is extremely hard to prosecute. But there's a lot that companies can do about this. And right now it doesn't look like they are really taking a stance in the right direction. For example, the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act would potentially, if passed, ban all products that are coming out of Xinjiang, which is a region at the very, very high level of forced labor. The US government itself has said that we can't know for sure that anything coming out from there is not made by forced labor, because auditors can't even go there to independently check the factories. No company sourcing from Xinjiang can actually say at the moment that I know my factory is not using forced labor, or I know for sure the contractors I'm working with are not associated with forced labor, because they cannot even check. Maybe before they could, but now the situation is entirely different. And also Xinjiang China has invested about $66 billion in 2017 in building infrastructure in Xinjiang, because it's a huge, huge strategic port for trade route for China. And it connects China to Europe. It connects China to the Middle East. It connects China to Central Asia. So that China's invested so much money there that it's almost too big to fail. And in 2017 was also when they invested that money, we saw that rise in Uyghur re-education camps and the mass arrest of Uyghurs there. So it was trade that started this particular mass detaining of ethnic minorities, which is what the Uyghurs are, then it is trade that can force China to rethink its policies towards Uyghurs. But unfortunately, most companies have not been taking a very good stance in this regard, because our companies like Apple, Nike, and Coca-Cola have been actively lobbying to not get this act passed in Congress or heavily revise it. Apple alone spent $90,000 lobbying against this act. So yes, there's a lot, our companies could be doing a lot better, but it doesn't look like that's where they're putting their money.
Yeah. I was interested and surprised to learn as I read your book, you know, there was a line where you said something like, you know, these prisoners are kept alive simply because of their usefulness in producing all of these products so quickly. But you also say that they are useful even in death, that there's good evidence that many of these prisoners, when they die or are executed, that their organs are then harvested. Talk about that.
Yes, China's organ market is extremely lucrative. It's $1 billion a year industry. And in 2019, I believe, the China Tribunal in London, which is an independent panel of investigators that include doctors, human rights lawyers, and other types of experts. They're independent, and they looked at all the evidence and confirmed that it was not medically possible for China to have that large of an organ supply based on natural death rates. There's a lot of hard evidence that China is executing prisoners, especially political prisoners, for the express purpose of selling their organs.
You know, I was struck by the fact that, as shocking as the information is in your book, most of us have at least a peripheral awareness that something like this has been happening, and yet we continue to buy these goods. And there's a real disconnect there. How do you account for that sort of cognitive dissonance that we know that something terrible is going on and that many of these products are produced under terrible conditions, and yet we continue to purchase them?
Yes, studies have shown that when we see an extremely low price and it looks like we're getting a bargain deal, our brains do light up. We feel joy, and it's hard to ignore that feeling. But I'm hopeful that so that's why, you know, traditionally, you know, whenever you hear news of a particular company or especially fashion companies using factories with egregious labor violations, a lot of times it doesn't actually impact their bottom line, despite the bad publicity, people keep buying from them. And I think that's why, it's because we just love to buy cheap goods. It literally makes us very happy. But studies have also shown that if we are truly aware of the how horrific some of these factories are, and the horror, really, if it exceeds a certain threshold, it's very, very hard to ignore at that point. Once it exceeds a certain threshold, the price no longer matters at that point. So I think what we're seeing with what new information we're learning about how horrific the sexual violence in these Uyghur camps are, especially, I think a lot of consumers, after knowing more about this, would have a hard time continuing to buy something just simply because it's cheap.
Yeah, which, you know, leads to the big question here, which is, you know, what can we do? Those of us who are reading your book, who are becoming more aware of what's happening, what do we do next?
Yeah, in my book, I do try to cover a lot of actual small steps that we can take, small changes we can make as consumers to really make a difference. And that includes, like, whatever your favorite brands are, whatever the stores that you love to shop at, you know, you're their target market. Just take a moment and look at their sustainability page or their corporate social responsibility page and see what it says, or see how little it says. If they're not revealing details like what kind of audits they perform, what kind of prices they charge their factory, how much time they actually give their factories to make these products, then if they're not revealing that level of detail about their sourcing practices, then you don't really know that there's no forced labor in their supply chain. And you can point that out to them, push them to really take their transparency to the next level. Go on social media, go on Facebook and Twitter and call out companies and have your posts go viral. And you know, it's that kind of a consumer-led movement can really make a significant change. I do want to talk about some hopeful changes that have happened historically. It's rather, because this topic is pretty dark. And that includes, for example, the Nike boycotts in the 1990s, you know, when we were first learning about the sweatshops. A lot of people were very shocked. Universities, students all over were boycotting Nike, and they were a huge target market, and Nike was quite worried about that. And while these kinds of boycotts didn't hurt Nike's bottom line in the long run, it did scare Nike and other multinational corporations enough that they made some significant changes in their sourcing practices and policies, which included doing audit reports and even releasing summaries of their audits. And that was really unprecedented. That couldn't have happened without consumers voicing their horrors and expressing their disappointment to Nike for using sweatshop labor. And I think since the 90s, there's just been so much more information that's come out about all these different companies and all these different human rights issues in factories all over the world. And it can feel really overwhelming to consumers. Like, who do we even target? How do we even create a focused movement or change again? But I would argue that we can hold all of our companies more accountable by asking them to do a simple thing like, okay, can you start rewriting your contracts at no extra expense to you? Just rewrite your contracts and ask and let the factory know that you might be occasionally sending someone who is, and you won't tell them the factory ahead of time that they're coming. You're just gonna occasionally send someone to follow the trucks that leave your factories to see which other factories they have relationships with, whether they are approved good factories. And there are good factories in China. It's not all labor camps. Or are they working with places that are quite obviously prison camps? You know, that was the only way that I could find out information about their relationships. And it actually was not all that difficult to follow the trucks. Surprisingly, we talked to the guards there. They were quite open about that, about how they worked with companies, because they just do it so often. It's just normal for them to talk about it with people that show up at the camp. A lot of business people show up at the camps to buy from them. And so if companies really wanted to find this information out, they could. And even if they didn't actually follow the factories, they could, if they just write in their contract that they will be doing this or they may be doing this, that will send a very serious message to their suppliers that this company is going to take this seriously. It doesn't want you to use forced labor. You don't want to risk losing a big contract with a huge company that was hard for you to get. You're going to do everything you can to make sure you don't get in trouble. And that could, that fact, that little thing alone could make a huge difference in terms of whether Chinese factories will use forced labor to make our products. And it's not going to really cost the company that much money to do it. And consumers can start asking their favorite brands to start making this change.
Well, on that note, let's go to some questions from our audience. I see that they are stacking up in here. All right, a couple of questions, actually, and I'd wondered about this too. Brian asks, are you persona non grata in China now for your reporting? And there's another question from Janice about, you know, being able to get in and to investigate. So can you talk a little bit about your experience going over there and doing your own investigation?
Yes, I actually had to go on a tourism visa and not a journalism visa. Because whenever someone goes on a journalism visa, they are followed by the police pretty much the entire time. It's really, really hard to get much reporting done. You have to come up with some pretty ingenious strategies to trick the police, and you have to have a lot of resources to do it and a lot of experience. So it's much easier to go on a tourism visa, but it's also more dangerous in a sense because you don't quite have the journalism protections that you normally would. But with that said, the foreign journalists who have never been Chinese nationals, like myself, do tend to have more protections, even if we do get caught by the police. They're probably going to detain us, or they might even be a little violent, but they're not going to imprison us for years at a time. They're not going to execute us if we are foreign journalists. But that's not the case with domestic journalists or even foreign journalists who were once Chinese nationals. So I felt that I was in a good position to do the reporting because I was technically a foreign journalist and I could speak Chinese and I kind of blend in when I do show up at these camps and seem like I'm one of them. And so yeah, luckily I didn't get into any trouble while I was there.
And you say that in a very matter-of-fact way, Amelia, but I have to wonder, I mean, there was still risk for you in undertaking that kind of an investigation and following the trucks, even though you were a foreign journalist. I mean, it was not without risk. How concerned were you for your own safety?
Yeah, I was a bit scared, to be honest. You know, especially during the time when I went, which was early 2019, China and the US were having a trade war and, you know, relations were kind of falling apart. I was nervous that I might just become, if I got detained, I could potentially become a pawn and China might use arrested Americans to try to punish the US government. And, you know, things that may not have happened before could start happening. And, So I was nervous, but luckily I didn't get detained.
A question from Francine, who says, who actually owns the factories?
The regular factories are owned by normal people, but the labor camps are owned by the state.
Okay, Arlo asks, are there groups that citizens can join to push back at these companies? Should we just stop buying Chinese goods? And also Arlo says, thank you for the valuable talk. So are there groups that that people can join?
That's a great question. There's a lot of different groups doing great work. One of them would be any of the Uyghur human rights groups, where there's the Uyghur Human Rights Project or some of the names are escaping me. I can post them on social media. I know the Uyghurs are especially active right now because their people are undergoing a genocide, especially active in getting the US government to pass some more serious legislation to stop forced labor from entering our stores.
Yeah. Eli asks, which companies, politicians, and others are champions of this issue, such as yourself, and how can we support them?
We'll see. Well, we could, I don't know who's actually a champion right now, or, but I would say there's a lot of politicians that could potentially become champions if you push them to. The Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act, which could potentially significantly be significant leverage to push China to change its policies. That was reintroduced in Congress recently, and you can push your representatives to support it.
Just as a follow-up from Eli, does the UN have a branch that monitors these types of issues, or who does?
The UN does comment on this and does some research, but ultimately I would say they can't do that much because China is a huge part of the UN. China is even a permanent member of the Security Council. So there may not be the best source for this particular issue.
Okay. Thomas asks, what are the top five made in China products that we should avoid to try and undermine the economic incentives for these policies? Even if we did put economic pressure on China by boycotting these products, do you think their policies would change? Or is the Chinese government driven as most by political ends, Or is the Chinese government driven as much by political ends as economic ends?
That's a great point. The Chinese government is extremely driven by political ends. Even if we could stop all forced labor goods from entering American ports and stores, China would probably still have these camps because it's very useful for them, and there's a lot of domestic Chinese companies that can source from them. So we can't stop the camps entirely, but we could at least do better to know that our products that we are buying are not, at least at the very least, not made by forced laborers, especially forced laborers associated with the genocide. Types of products that we could target, I would say the products are so many, there's so many, but probably the best thing to target would be to try to find out or push companies to release this information if you can't find out. Who is still sourcing from Xinjiang? And if they are sourcing from Xinjiang, are they willing to pull out? Xinjiang is extremely, it's one region with huge trade importance to China. And it's a region with a high level of forced labor. It's a region associated with the genocide. The research has shown that in recent years, two of the largest Uyghur areas in Xinjiang, two of the largest prefectures where Uyghurs live, had a like over 80% decrease in birth rates due to the forced sterilization and forced abortions that the Uyghurs currently have to go in these camps, or even when they're not in the camps, just living in Xinjiang, they have to undergo these procedures. And according to one of the UN's definitions for genocide, suppression of birth does qualify as a genocide.
Grace asks, is anyone looking at other countries besides China and finding similar practices and or better standards?
That is a great question. Yeah, you do see companies that are moving out of China to look for even cheaper suppliers, because you know the wages are rising in a lot of the developed cities and factories, and they're trying to source from even cheaper places, like a lot of African countries and Vietnam or India. You know, they're really and even Mexico. And so are the conditions there better? I don't know if they are. You know, there's definitely been some reports of a lot of child labor, underage labor, and in these types of countries where there isn't a whole lot of good labor laws that are enforced yet. So no, it's definitely an issue that extends beyond China.
Tom asks, are Chinese citizens aware of these work camps, slave conditions, and are they concerned with quality issues of their products that are exported to other countries?
I think some are, but most people are probably not aware of these camps or how horrific they are. That's because if you live in China and you've only lived in China your entire life, you don't really have access to uncensored news. There's just one state-controlled news source where all the media is basically controlled by the state and pretty much report things with the same angle. There's a lot of stories that they won't cover, or a lot of angles that they won't necessarily cover. And in order to get alternative viewpoints, you have to get a virtual privacy network, a VPN, and that's extremely difficult to get while you're in China. A lot of people can get it by leaving China and then downloading a VPN and then coming back. But even that's really risky. If the government finds out you have an unregistered VPN, you could go to prison. You could go to a labor camp yourself. So it's very, very hard for people to even access uncensored information about what's really happening in these labor camps.
A question from Evadna, and this is something that others may be wondering as well. The province that you mentioned where so many of these camps are, can you spell the name of that province? There may be people who want to look it up and do some research.
Great question. It is Xinjiang, and that's Xinjiang.
Okay, let's see here. So there's a question here about Falun Gong, because you write extensively about the Falun Gong group and how many of them have ended up in these camps. And it says, Phil says, the Falun Gong are having conversation groups to make Americans aware of the imprisonment of Uyghurs. Are you aware of that and the efforts that Falun Gong is undertaking to try to spread awareness?
Outside of China, I'm not so familiar, not so aware. I've mostly been concentrating on the dissident work they've been doing in the U.S.
Yeah.
I can't comment on that.
Okay. Question from Brian. Do you expect that human rights will have any teeth under the Biden administration?
It's possible. It's in the early stages of the administration, and we can only hope that it will.
Yeah. Follow-up question to that from Brian. Aren't conditions in most Chinese factories onerous for workers? I know that you mentioned that there are, good legitimate factories in China. Are working conditions generally difficult in factories there, or what have you found?
For sure, there's a lot of even normal factories that don't have great working conditions. Even though China is a Chinese Communist Party, they don't allow labor unions, independent labor unions, so nobody can actually really even advocate for workers' rights there without risking getting sent to a labor camp yourself. Apple's Foxconn suppliers have been notorious. In recent years, they made a lot of headlines about the suicides that have occurred in their factories. Mm. There's a lot of other even normal factories where the conditions are not great.
Yeah. Tom asks a question about whether you feel any personal danger having written the book. And that sort of leads to a separate question where in the book, at the very end, you thank your family in China and you say, I'm sorry if this makes life more difficult for you. Can you talk a little bit more about that? You are of Uyghur descent, I understand. And can you talk a little bit about that and concern for family over there?
Yes, I am very, very concerned. I haven't talked to them about it because our only communications are through WeChat, which is a Chinese government-owned app. And, it's surveilled pretty tightly. They have bots and algorithms that can detect certain types of words. If you just have certain types of discussions, you could get into a lot of trouble. So I don't know how they're doing or if this has had any impact on them. And I do worry about that.
Yeah. Question from Mark. And I know you touched on this, but perhaps you could elaborate a little bit. Mark says, are prisoners performing the work for these factories arrested for a period of time, or are they being held indefinitely?
It depends on the camp. In the re-education through labor camps, the average was around 2.5 years. That's what the average informal sentence was. They haven't been sentenced in a court. It's just what the police sentenced them, really. Some of them are pretty much there for life. It really depends on, because it is kind of arbitrary. It's hard to say. It varies.
Grace asks, what are some companies that are doing it right?
There's definitely some companies that are doing better than others. I don't know if necessarily doing it right or doing the best that they can. And that's what our job is. We can encourage them to do that. But yeah, I noticed some do release a bit more information. They will have pictures of their factories. They'll have audit summaries of their factories. And that may be more than what a lot of companies actually reveal. A lot of companies reveal, the full list of their factories and their addresses, and that's good to a certain extent. But a lot of companies really should be revealing more information than that, if we can really know for sure, for us to really be sure that they're not using forced labor.
Yeah. Before we begin to wrap up our program here, Amelia, I just want to read you a couple of notes from our audience. Janice says she admires you. You are brave. Evelyn says a comment of gratitude for what you care about and the desire and ability to express what is so important for us to know and do what we can to help. Many thanks and continue what you do in continued good health. Stay well and be safe. Lovely note there from Evelyn and Brian. Thanks you as well for the work that you have done. So a lot of appreciation, Amelia, from our audience for the work that you have done here.
Thank you so much. I wish we were doing it in person so I could actually meet everyone.
Well, and just before we close, I know that you did give us some ideas on ways that all of us can either change our behavior, maybe put some pressure on some companies, do some research. If there were one big idea that you wanted readers to take away from your book, what would it be?
Well, my book does list a full list of questions maybe you can start asking companies. But in terms of one big idea, I think maybe just the awareness that a lot of times it's us as consumers chasing the latest trends for the cheapest prices that are contributing to factories having to outsource work to forced labor to meet our production demands. So the next time we want to buy something kind of frivolous, just take a moment and think, do we really need this? Or can we really think about to do it? And start buying things on a need basis rather than a want basis. And you know, if everyone started doing that, I think it can make a profound change on how factories produce products on the other side of the world.
Yeah. The book is called Made in China, A Prisoner, an SOS Letter, and the Hidden Cost of America's Cheap Goods. If you don't already have the book, we have a link to the Joseph Fox Bookshop where you can get the book, but really, really important reading. Amelia Peng, thank you so much for writing this book, for taking the risks that it took you to get this information for us and for putting this book out there into the world for us. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Tracy, for taking the time to read my book and prepare a great conversation. Thank you so much to the Philadelphia Free Library for having me and hosting this event. I hope I can meet all of you in person one day. Thanks so much.
Well, we want to thank our audience for all of your great questions, for taking some time to discuss this very, very important topic with us tonight. And as always, we want to thank the Free Library of Philadelphia, Jason Freeman, who you met at the beginning, Andy Cahan, Laura Kovacs, the whole author events team. We want to thank them for bringing these great events to all of us. So thanks for joining us, everyone. Have a great night. Stay safe and warm, and we'll see you next time. Good night.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.